on the street lights. We cultivate the culture, bring forth your contribution. City unite, rhymes, poetry, knowledge, wisdom, understanding, and being stupid. City unite, put in work, network, F work, do something, make it happen, make it work, yo. City unite, flyers, we pay, spray paint, make your mark, don't backtrack, grab your backpack.
The one from the Valley of the Sun, Master None.
Welcome to the InfoShop News Podcast for February 19th, 2006. I'm Chuck Munson, the editor of InfoShop News, and I'll be hosting this second installment of our new podcast. This podcast is a collaboration of the InfoShop News Collective and volunteers on several continents. In this edition, we will hear part two of an interview I did last year with John Becken, who will be talking about what the IWW is doing these days. We'd like to thank all of you who listened to our first podcast. We got lots of encouraging feedback, so we will be continuing this project for the foreseeable future. We invite all of you who listen to consider contributing to the project in some way. You can read audio for us. You can send us contributions, send us story ideas. All of those can be sent to us via the infoshop.org website, or send to me, Chuck Munson, with my email address being chuck@mutualaid.org. Normally, Erica would be reading the news for us, the roundup of InfoShop news from the past week, but she had some problems this week getting the file to us. So we hope we can clear those technical problems up next week, and we'll have the news via Erica. InfoShop news for February 19th. 2006. Here is a sampling of some of the stories that are available currently on the InfoShop News website. Imprisoned in New Orleans by Jordan Flaherty and Tamika Milton from Color Lines magazine. When Hurricane Katrina hit, there was no evacuation plan for 7,000 prisoners in the New Orleans City Jail, generally known as Orleans Parish Prison, OPP, or the approximately 1,500 prisoners in nearby jails. According to first-hand accounts gathered by advocates, prisoners were abandoned in their cells while the water was rising around them. They were subjected to a heavily armed rescue by state prison guards that involved beatings, mace, and being left in the sun with no water or food for several days, followed by a transfer to state maximum security prisons. Although their treatment brought national attention to the condition of prisoners in Louisiana, in comparison to prison abuse scandals from Attica to Abu Ghraib, local government officials have attempted to dodge accountability and continue with business as usual. The first anarchistic festival of Montreal. Newly created Anarchist Theater Festival is now in search of submissions of anarchistic plays, which will be presented May 8th and 9th, 2006, in Sala Rosa. It will be the first event of its kind in North America. The festival is organized within the framework of the Festival of Anarchy, an annual event in Montreal, which will be concluded with the 7th Anarchist Book Room of Montreal that will take place May 20th and 21st, 2006. It is the largest anarchist event in North America. The website is anarchistbookfair.tactic, that's TAKTIC.org, and they have an email address, anarchistfestival@yahoo.ca. Classism in the Stacks, Libraries and Poor People by Sanford Berman. Why the cascading efforts to exclude homeless people from public spaces, deny them fair access to library resources, and treat them as pariahs? It seems to result from living in a plutocracy where money and wealth not only rule, but also determine status and social worth. The American Library Association, ALA, approved its policy on library services for poor people, Policy 61, in 1990, 15 years ago. It should enjoy the same status as the Library Bill of Rights, another ALA policy that establishes norms or standards for collection, development, and facilities use. But it doesn't. Unlike the immediately preceding policy on minority concerns, ALA units have never been canvassed on what they had done or what to do to implement the poor people's policy. Hundreds of institutions have formally adopted the Library Bill of Rights as their own policy and often frame and display it in the library itself. I know of no library that has similarly adopted and publicized the Poor People's Policy, PPP. Indeed, only weeks ago, a library board candidate in Minneapolis pointedly asked the MPL directors about such an adoption. The answer? The library is for everybody. Why focus on one particular demographic? Why striking bus drivers in Tehran are the real defenders of Muslim rights? It's an article by Nick Cohen, who writes for The Observer newspaper in the UK. For 3 weeks, there have been demonstrations across the planet about a great injustice done to Muslims. After baton-wielding cops inflicted dozens of injuries, the fear of death is in the air. George W. Bush's State Department has warned of systematic oppression, while secularists and fundamentalists have revealed their mutually incompatible values. Since you ask, I am not talking about the global menace of Scandinavian cartoonists that has so terrified our fearless free press, but mass arrests in Iran. Veterans and survivors marched from Mobile to New Orleans. March 19, 2006 is the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Veterans for Peace, Iraq Veterans Against the War, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, Military Families Speak Out, Gold Star Families for Peace, and Hurricane Survivors Organizations are organizing a 5-day march along Gulf Coast Highway 90 to demand the immediate return of our troops from Iraq and to call for U.S. tax dollars to be spent on human priorities and rebuilding of the devastated Gulf Coast instead of the illegal occupation of Iraq. This is happening March 14th through the 19th, 2006, and they have a website which is www.vetgulfmarch.org. That's www.vetgulfmarch, all one word, .org. Starbucks engaging in religious persecution of IWW barista. For the second time in as many months, Starbucks management has kicked SWU member Suli Ayala out of the workplace for wearing her modest pentagram necklace. Ms. Ayala is a practicing Wiccan and as a religious observance never takes off the necklace. She wore the necklace at Starbucks without interruption for 3 years until the company started harassing her after she and a group of her co-workers went public as members of the Starbucks Workers Union on November 18, 2005. And that was a brief roundup of some of the news and opinion featured this week on InfoShop News. InfoShop News can be reached at news.infoshop.org, and that's without a www.
Tell me that I will be okay.
That was Three More by Del Cielo, a band based in Washington, D.C. InfoShop News interviewed John Beckin in September 2005 at the Radical Economics and the Labor Movement Conference, which was held here in Kansas City. Beckin is currently a professor at Albright College. He is editor of Industrial Worker, the monthly newspaper of the IWW, and he's a member of the editorial collective for Anarcho-Syndicalist Review. This is part two of the interview, which will feature today John's thoughts on the current state of the IWW and some of their organizing campaigns. In part three, we will talk to John Beckin about alternative media. The InfoShop News podcast will be featuring more interviews in future shows, including some new audio from the National Conference on Organized Resistance that was recently held in Washington, D.C.
And then we also have a campaign right now on in Scotland to try and force the Scottish Parliament to pay wages to 14 workers that we represent, parliamentary staff, people who work in local offices, and, you know, awesome. The Scottish Socialist Party recognized the IWW as the bargaining agent for their workers because the workers came and said, we want union representation. And unfortunately, or maybe, you know, it's a question of how you look at it, they decided to hold a demonstration within the chambers of the Socialist Party. Not our members, the parliamentary delegation. They held up a banner saying that the government should allow workers to protest against the G8 summit. And for this, the parliament decided to cut off their wages, which, you know, that's between them and the parliamentarians, as far as I'm concerned. Politicians, you pay them, you don't pay them, you know, that's not my concern. I'd be against shooting them for this. It would be, if you're going to shoot politicians, it should be on better grounds, right? But to cut off the wages of our members, that is intolerable. And, you know, we've informed them that we, you know, we're going to sue them if they don't actually end up paying, and they're trying to backtrack and say, it's not that we're not paying them, we're just not paying the parliamentarians their allowances out of which the work. No, they're going to pay our people. Right now, they're still maintaining they're not going to, but they are going to pay our people. And we're organizing demonstrations, we're, you know, consulting with legal counsel. We do not intend to stand by and have 14 of our members employed by the Scottish Parliament. It can afford to pay our members' wages, and it is going to.
So how about the future? What looks promising?
I think a number of these campaigns that we have going, we're doing much more strategic organizing. When I came in the union, we tended, somebody would get pissed off at work, which is an easy thing to do. You know, bosses are all the time pissing you off, right? And they would call up the union and say, what can you do? And we'd try and do something. And sometimes you'd line up a shop, you know, get a majority fairly quickly, and the boss would capitulate and you'd have something for a while. Other times, the boss would be really resistant. A lot of these petty bosses, they'd rather go out of business than, you know, deal with their workers. And we did a lot of these campaigns. We sort of ran from, you know, hotspot to hotspot. Now we're trying to sit down much more and think about how we can build some real power. So like with this messengers campaign, most messenger organizing, not just ours, a lot of other unions have been doing it for several years now, they would pick a shop, organize that shop. But what happens then is if you win anything at that shop, it charges higher rates, the work starts migrating to other shops, the shop goes under, and, you know, you're back where you started. So we're trying to organize the whole industry. Mm-hmm. And we've been putting a lot of effort into, and also not just like the bike messengers, which is how a lot of people have done it, but there's a lot of drivers too. We're trying to organize the drivers because they can move the stuff. I mean, they can't entirely in the heart of downtown Chicago move between bikes and cars, but to some extent things can move back and forth. And in some ways the car messengers have higher expenses, you know. The companies no more pay for their cars than they pay for the bikes, right?
Right.
So they certainly have reasons to organize, and so we've been making a real effort to map out that industry and organize and really reach out well beyond the core people who initially approached us in that drive. Same kind of thing, the South Street campaign originated with a branch retreat where we sat down and talked about what are the large unorganized pools of workers in this city. Where could we go and make a difference? We already represented in Philadelphia at that time three shops. It's not that, you know, we didn't have organizing going on. It's that we wanted to do something that was more strategic, where we could really make a difference, in a fairly dramatic difference in conditions. And I think that is the future. Some campaigns get a lot of attention. So like when we organized the one Starbucks in New York City, it's all over the world, right? But if you organize one Starbucks in New York City, and then you go to the employers, in fact, what happens is they start firing people and, you know, hauling you, you know. But let's say that they decided not to do that route and instead to sit down and bargain in good faith with you like the law requires. You know, be good corporate citizens and do what they're required to do. Are they going to give higher wages to the one union Starbucks in New York City when I can't imagine that you can walk two blocks in any direction without running into another Starbucks? I mean, it would be insane for them to give you anything of substance in that situation, right? Because you would walk two blocks away and say, you know, we organized a union and now we get 25 cents an hour more. It would just be a natural kind of a thing. And pretty soon, all the workers in Starbucks, they would be wanting unions. So management can't give you anything like that. I mean, you have to have a campaign if you want to organize these chains. And we have a number of chain campaigns going right now. You have to have a campaign to think strategically about how you can build a big enough base. Doesn't have to be a majority necessarily. It has to be enough people that you can engage in collective activity that the boss will notice, that, you know, will be disruptive to the boss. And sometimes two or three people in 50 shops might make more of a difference to the boss than the same number of people in a handful of shops, because they can reach out to their coworkers, they can agitate around some sort of agreements, it can happen at multiple points, which, you know, can draw the energy, and they can't as easily close 50 shops as they can two or three where your support is concentrated.
Have the techniques of organizing changed much in recent years, or is it still just the nitty-gritty of...
And we're putting a lot more emphasis. We have a major organizer training program we've been running for the last 3 years now, where every year we do dozens of sessions around U.S. and Canada, where we sit down, walk people through primarily how to talk to people, to formulate, you know, bring together individual complaints and make them, you know, shape them into collective grievances, to mobilize around those. We do have a little bit of unit on labor law and how, you know, but we focus on that not as a tactic for winning, but it offers you certain extremely limited protections, and there are certain strategic moments when you might want to avail yourself of them. You can't rely on it to win your campaign, but sometimes it can help, you know, with little aspects. So we've been running these campaigns to try and give people a much, you know, at the rank and file, the grassroots members who are carrying out our organizing, to give them more confidence on the one hand, but also tools to work with to change the conditions of their work. And the emphasis in this in our trainings, in the materials we've been developing, is really on how do you act union from the day you start organizing. So many campaigns, and the IWW used to fall victim to this too, not back in the 20s, but in the 50s, 60s, 70s, we had lost some of the traditions on which the union was built. And so you have this tradition that you go out and you say, you know, if we got a union in here, we could make conditions better. And you get people to join the union. And then the union gets certified. Maybe you struggle or strike. Maybe you get an election. Then you bargain a contract. And, you know, there's a lot of occasion for things to go wrong between the time when you start organizing, and maybe it takes 2 or 3 months to get a majority, and then you ask for an election. Maybe it takes 3 or 4 months to get the government to get around to giving you an election. And then you negotiate a contract. I was involved in negotiations on a contract recently, which dragged on for 20 months before the workers threw up their hands in disgust and said, hell with this. You know, there's a lot of opportunity for things to go wrong there. And generally speaking, we're not so well off as workers that we can afford to wait for 2 or 3 years to resolve our problems. We need faster action than that. So we're working on strategies. How do you address, as you organize around immediate problems, you work to get those problems solved. And the result of that, if you work that effectively, is A, you build people's sense of their own power. B, you actually resolve some grievances. You know, you do get some things accomplished. People are able to see for themselves the benefits of collective action. And even if you never get to majority status, you ought to be able to build a cadre of people who make it impossible for conditions to go back to the way they used to be. And that unionism then you can carry with you from job to job, and you can begin to create through industries, through districts, some sort of a, you know, consciousness a sense of awareness, a sense of resistance that puts real limits on what the employers are able to do.
To a place never been nor seen. Scream out loud, this is a dream. Dream that I made it, it's in this way. With a tune that I played, on a play that I swayed. Unshrunk anyway, small disc when I play. Move from the way, move from the path. Don't know, think I'm gonna laugh. At your pole pimpin' ass. Dancing around like a new in a mask. Watch our flesh, not for the test. But a mess up, gone head fest. Up, wanna be a real MC. In another scene, living a dream. No truth, no time. Got about another rhyme. Can't swing your shine cause you don't got one. Don't rhyme the groove, I rhyme the move. Mind stuck in a stagnant groove. Done hurt before, been had in a stone. Not new no more, been used. Hella old, remote, remake, right, retake. Crush, major bridge, break. Real is a feel, not something you can take. God for the mind, alone, not built from a clone. Time from home, makes it worth the while. And leave from, we'll know where you got it from. Find another source, son. Gotta be the only one.
That was music from The Deep Thinkers, a hip-hop group in Kansas City. We turn now to an in-depth news segment featuring a new InfoShop News report by Kerry Leiterson on the situation in New Orleans. Building on common ground, New Orleans activist group provides an alternative, by Kerry Leiterson. For InfoShop News, this was published on February 17, 2006. New Orleans. The little blue house rising out of the rubble looks almost like a mirage, surrounded by a sea of jumbled cinder blocks, twisted pieces of iron, overturned and smashed cars, and whole houses buckled in on themselves or tossed off their foundations. The blue house is neat and bright, and its well-swept yard sprouts a few flowers and protest signs saying, "Welcome home, Lower Ninth Ward residents," and "No eminent domain." This is the work of the Common Ground Collective, a grassroots group founded in the wake of Hurricane Katrina by two local activists and staffed by locals and thousands of visiting volunteers. In response to the serious dearth of material aid and rebuilding, health care, informational, and other services from government agencies, Common Ground volunteers have snapped into action to provide everything from health care, food, clothing, supplies, and internet access to help gutting and rebuilding houses, legal advice, and political resistance against what many see as the city's plans to level the Lower Ninth Ward and turn it into green space, like a park or a golf course, or other uses that don't include the former residents. Several volunteers moved into the Blue House, as it is called, in early January, just after the area was finally open to residents and the public. They slept there without heat, electricity, or running water, in defiance of a curfew that prohibited even residents from staying overnight in their homes. The group figured if they were arrested, they could use their case to challenge the constitutionality of the curfew. But they weren't, and the curfew was dropped soon after. The house, donated by a resident, is practically in the shadow of the overturned barge that breached the levee nearby with a flood of water that virtually flattened the neighborhood and killed many residents. Common Ground members figured that by setting up an outpost right by the barge and levee breach, they could more easily force the media and visiting politicians to listen to the residents' demands that they be allowed to rebuild in their former home. "This was all these people know," said Dena Trufant, whose father narrowly escaped from his home in the ward, as she drove through to survey the damage. "They need to rebuild it." Common Ground volunteers, as many as 1,000 any given week, are slowly helping to gut and clear properties in the Lower Ninth. They hold regular meetings for residents at the house, discussing legal options, property rights, cleanup strategies, and other issues. Across the canal, several miles up Claiborne Street from the Blue House, in the Upper Ninth Ward, Common Ground's main headquarters is a bustling settlement of tents, stacks of supplies, bunks, and a decontamination station. The organization is headquartered in a Baptist church and its gravel parking lot. Displaced residents and long-term volunteers sleep in hastily but sturdily constructed three-high bunks walled off into rooms with tarps and blankets in the church. Across the street, the parking lot hosts a tent city and distribution center with meticulously organized free goods, including canned food, pasta, and other edibles, toys, clothes, baby diapers, and supplies, even nail polish. On the sidewalk outside the church, the decontamination station, with a series of buckets with different solutions to decontaminate rubber boots, gloves, and other protective gear for gutting houses. Posters and handouts describe how to deal with mold and the chemical and industrial toxins spread everywhere by the flood. Next to the tent city, a cute house in the process of being rebuilt inside hosts a medical clinic and a health clinic. Separated by walls of bare slats, volunteer attorneys and nursing students do workshops and offer basic health care and supplies. We're doing a comprehensive community health needs assessment, finding out where people get care before, said Noah Morris, 23, a volunteer from Providence, Rhode Island, who is now studying nursing at a local community college. We distribute self-testing kits, we have an acupuncturist, an herbalist, and we do rapid HIV testing. We're trying to get more lab equipment and staff so we can play a primary care role in people's lives. The group living situation and decision-making processes at Common Ground and the interaction between mostly low-income black residents and mostly white, relatively well-off young volunteers has presented many challenges and lessons regarding racism, classism, sexism, and solidarity and tolerance to organizers. One girl asked a woman to keep her voice down, and she said, "White people have been telling me to keep my voice down all my life. In Africa, you speak your mind and you let out your emotions," said Brandon Darby, one of the long-term Common Ground organizers. Common Ground was founded within days of Hurricane Katrina by a local former Black Panther and longtime activist named Malik Rahim, and another local activist named Sharon Jones. It started as a first aid station in Algiers, the largely impoverished black neighborhood across the Mississippi River from downtown New Orleans. The first aid station quickly spawned other projects and drew a range of local and national supporters. Soon there was a full-scale health clinic in Algiers in a donated mosque. The clinic, which was slated to move from the mosque to another building this winter, is regularly packed with residents who get medical advice and basic care from volunteer doctors and nurses and other volunteers. Near the Algiers clinic are several food and clothing distribution centers. In addition to the Blue House, the Algiers sites, and the main Common Ground headquarters, there is also a media center with free internet and a low-power radio station, and a women's center. An outreach project to mostly Latino migrant workers is in the works. The group gets no funding from the government and survives mostly on individual donations, along with a few grants, as well as extensive in-kind donations. Among others, they've gotten donations from filmmaker Michael Moore and the group Veterans for Peace. In March, members plan to meet with representatives of President Hugo Chavez's government in Venezuela to take the country up on offers of aid that the U.S. government refused. Currently, they are raising $30,000 to buy heavy-duty tents for residents who are being evicted from temporary shelters, according to Darby. Common Ground has been met with both hostility and grudging respect and cooperation from various government agencies, according to organizers. Several members were arrested for blockading the street with an aid truck. Others have had guns shoved in their faces by police and private security guards. But they say that in other cases, government workers have turned to them for information or support. "Off the books," in Darby's words. Along with offering concrete aid and assistance, the group has a larger political viewpoint and strategy of challenging capitalist and segregationist development procedures and inequality and racism in general. Members say politicians and mainstream media have lauded their efforts but downplayed their political message. "We try to take a really challenging stance," said Darby, "especially now that we have so much support nationally and internationally." Common Ground's relationships with residents and other activists and community groups in the city have apparently been positive overall, though controversial and rocky in some respects, largely because of the racial dynamics and economic inequalities between residents and volunteers. The group has forged alliances with some other local groups and churches, but hasn't been able to see eye to eye with others. Meanwhile, along with the Katrina-related challenges, Common Ground members are hoping to develop a grassroots infrastructure to respond to future disasters in the New Orleans area or beyond. They want to identify places where evacuees can be quickly and comfortably relocated, and they want to have equipment and medical supplies ready to respond to disasters. If Katrina is any example of how the federal government responds, we need to have people watching, making a critical analysis, and being ready to respond ourselves, Darby said. Carrie Leiterson is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in the Washington Post, in the Times, Lip Magazine, Clamor, and the New Standard. Infoshop.org has a page on Hurricane Katrina mutual aid relief, and that address is www.infoshop.org/hurricanekatrina.html. Infoshop News can be found on the internet at news.infoshop.org. We bring you a variety of independent and mainstream news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can reach us by sending an email to chuck@mutualaid.org or by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of each page. We'd like to thank a few people for making this podcast possible. Erica and William for helping produce this show. Carrie Leiterson for her recent reports from New Orleans. The Drunken Immortals for the music at the top of the show. And Strike Anywhere for the music you're about to hear. We'll talk to you again in a few weeks.
When they broke down the door, put the guards in the face of your wife and child. And as they pinned you to the floor, did you say, "Officer, I'm not resisting you"? American justice, American justice.